Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and analyze statements from Israel's Shimon Peres saying the clock is ticking for a military strike on Iran and warnings from the Russian foreign minister that an attack on Iran would be a very serious mistake fraught with unpredictable consequences. Gideon Levy, the former spokesman for Shimon Peres, joins us to provide an Israeli's perspective on whether the increasingly isolated Netanyahu government is determined to strike Iran. Then we'll look into the task of cutting $450 billion from the defense budget over 10 years that the Secretary of Defense is wrestling with. Or failing agreement by the Congressional Supercommittee, Panetta could find himself facing $500 billion in additional reductions over the next decade. We will speak with Russell Rumbaugh, who was a defense analyst on the Senate Budget Committee and is author of the new report, What We Bought, Procurement from Fiscal Year 01 to Fiscal Year 2010. We will discuss how much of the decade-long $700 billion defense budget that has doubled since 9/11 will be cut and how. Then William Hartung joins us to provide a different perspective on the defense budget and how to cut it. He is the project director of the Center for International Policy and the author of Profits for War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Joining us now is Gideon Levy, who is an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz and is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres. His books include Twilight Zone, Life and Death Under the Israeli Occupation and The Punishment of Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And your old boss is making headlines. Shimon Peres says on Sunday, the possibility of a military attack against Iran is now closer to being applied than the application of the diplomatic option. And of course, this has led the Russian foreign minister to warn that this would be a very serious mistake fraught with unpredictable consequences. So let's start with Shimon Peres. This is not exactly news that there's been speculation. It came from Maya Dagan, the former head of Mossad, who felt that Netanyahu was isolated, surrounded by hawks, and that the normal checks and balances from the intelligence professionals their counsel wasn't being heard because too many of the senior people had resigned. So let's start from that position then. How real is this, do you think, Gideon?
Nobody can tell, or very, very few can tell. But the public debate in Israel is a very healthy one because they think that it is about such a cardinal, such a fatal decision that it cannot be taken just by two, three politicians or two, three generals. And we are dealing here really with explosive material that can change the whole Middle East, that might even change Israel. Hopefully this attack will not take place. Hopefully Israel will understand that not everything is possible, and for sure not everything is possible by force.
And do you think, though, that my understanding is that the U.S. administration, the Obama administration, has been quite alarmed at this prospect for some time, and Panetta has been over there. I think Mullen has also been over there. Presumably the American national security people and the top military and intelligence people have been leaning on Netanyahu. So do you think that there could be some kind of a deal that would come out of that? In other words, the Americans are saying to Netanyahu, don't do this. The consequences are too drastic. And then Netanyahu says, well, if you won't let us do it, you better do something. Do you think that's going on?
Look, one thing is very clear. If the American administration will be very, very devoted and will be very, very clear telling Israel not to do it, Israel will never dare to do it. The question is how devoted and how clear is the American administration in its objection to a military attack on Iran? Anything is possible and any speculation might be the right one. It can be, it might be that the Americans are just saving face. It can be that the Israelis just want to hear the American no. Nobody knows. It's the arena is full of speculations, But one thing is very clear. If the United States will be very decisive in its objection, Israel will never dare to do something against a very clear American no. The question is, how clear and how devoted is the American no?
Well, logically, Gideon Levy, in an election year, if the price of oil went up to $10 a gallon, the president would be toast. I mean, the consequences of an attack on Iran are fairly unforeseen, but most analysts suggest that Iran has a fairly robust ability to retaliate through Hezbollah. They have extended-range rockets that could rain down on Israel, but they could also turn their rockets on Saudi Arabia and or the Gulf of Hormuz and shut down Western oil supplies. So that would be a pretty tough call for a president to make, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say, but I would also I would like to be much more convinced that all the decisions of the American administrations are always based only on logic. And unfortunately, it's not the case always. But yes, according to logic, there is no logic in an attack, neither by Israel nor by the United States, for sure not in the present timing. No logic, because they don't have the bomb yet. I believe they will never use the bomb. And I believe that even an attack will not prevent them of getting a bomb. It will just postpone it in a few years and maybe push them even harder to get the bomb.
Again, I'm speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz and is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres. His books include Twilight Zone, Life and Death After, Under the Israeli Occupation, and The Punishment of Gaza. And we're talking about speculation in Israel, which has been going on for some time, that Netanyahu is considering, along with Barak, the defense minister. I mean, this is not Netanyahu alone that hawkish intentions are attributed to him. But I guess the reason we're talking here, Gideon, is that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is about to release a report either Tuesday or Wednesday that supposedly has some convincing evidence that Iran is moving quite precipitously towards nuclear weapons. They apparently have some fissile material, maybe enough for four bombs, but more importantly, apparently they have designs of miniature warheads that would fit on ballistic missiles, and they've had the help of some former Soviet nuclear scientists, which is of course an interesting irony given the warning by the Russian defense minister Sergei Lavrov.
Yeah, these are all fearful news, but maybe we'll have to learn to live with the fact that Iran has a bomb, like we are living, unfortunately so, with the fact that North Korea has a bomb and Pakistan has a bomb. There are no less dangerous regimes there. I wish this will not become true. I wish Iran will not have nuclear weapons, but I'm not sure that we can do everything to prevent it. And I'm not sure that the alternative of bombing Iran is not more dangerous right now.
So how prevalent is your point of view that, because it's completely the opposite to what we are told is the response to a nuclear-armed Iran as an existential threat to the very survival of Israel?
It is an existential threat, that's for sure. But I believe that this is a threat that Israel has to live with, like many other threats. The threat of attacking Iran and getting in return thousands of missiles on Israel is a very much more concrete threat and must be also taken into consideration. I truly believe that Iran knows very well that the moment that they will touch the nuclear weapons that they might have one day, the moment that they will use it, this will be the end of Iran, because Israel might react and will react and the world will react, and that's the end of Iran. And I don't think that in Iran they don't know this.
Well, one of the things that's surprising about the current sense of quarantining Iran and the fear that exists out there, and this was also expressed by your former boss Shimon Peres on Israeli television on Sunday. He said, "I estimate that intelligence services of all these countries are looking at the ticking clock, warning leaders that there is not much time left." And apparently there is, if you could describe it as an alliance, you have Israel and the United States, to a lesser extent, apparently Sarkozy and Obama spoke about this at the G20 conference as well. But the interesting part of the mix is that Saudi Arabia's in there too. You have Israel and Saudi Arabia essentially allies in their concern about an Iranian nuclear weapon, given this recent report that there was an Iranian plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador, who's the very ambassador that in the WikiLeaks revelation that called for cutting off the head of the snake, meaning getting rid of the regime in Tehran.
Yeah, it's all true, and also Egypt might be another ally, and everyone in the West and everyone elsewhere is really hoping and must do anything possible to prevent nuclear weapons in the hands of these Ayatollah's regimes. There's no doubt about this. The only question is if bombing is the way to achieve it. And I think that diplomatic steps and sanctions are much less dangerous and maybe more effective.
Well, what about this sort of de facto alliance between Israel and the Saudis? We know that back in early 2000, the Saudis approached Israel with a peace plan, and recently Maya Dagan, the former head of Mossad, in criticizing Netanyahu for having these hawkish intentions to strike Iran, he also mentioned what a disaster it was that they dropped the ball on the Saudi peace initiative. So, given what's happening now in Syria, where the Iranians' regime is concerned that they're going to lose their ally Assad, and that there's more and more the lines are being drawn in a kind of cold war between the Sunni and the Shia, it would seem to me that would be the worst possible outcome, wouldn't it be? That at the moment where Iran is on the ropes and perhaps is going to lose Syria, wouldn't this be the time not to give them an excuse that the West is attacking them and not to play into the very narrative that the Iranian regime is putting out there?
Yeah, I might agree to everything you said, and still I want to remind you that bombing Iran, according to all the experts, will not prevent Iran of having nuclear weapons. It will just postpone it in few months or few years, not more than this. And on the other hand, it might explode the entire Middle East in their reaction together with the Hezbollah and the Hamas. It can become into something that we have never seen before. This must be taken into consideration. And I think that the world has to do anything possible to prevent Iran of having nuclear weapons, but also to realize that, like it happened with North Korea and Pakistan, it might happen also with Iran.
So what is the Israeli response, though, to obviously the region is changing in dramatic ways starting with Tunisia, then Egypt, and we know that that's had a serious impact on Israel's relationship with Egypt. But what about what's going on to the north with Syria, a regime that seems to be it's not on the ropes. It's obviously a brutal and well entrenched regime, but its brutality towards its own people, I think, is leading towards an inevitable armed struggle inside of Syria. And the Turks seem to be taking the side of the rebellion, if you will. Israel's been strangely silent on this. So tell us what's going on from the Israeli perspective.
No, Israel should be silent about it. Israel should be very careful not to interfere in any domestic Arab matters, not to interfere in the so-called Arab Spring, sit and wait. Anyhow, Israel is not on the agenda now in Syria. They are struggling about domestic issues, same for Egypt, same for all the Arab countries. They are now much more preoccupied with domestic issues, and very good so. And Israel can only be damaged by interfering. Israel should sit still, and this is what Israel is doing, I must tell you. Israel is trying, at least on the surface, not to interfere, just to watch and to see what will be the outcome.
But already things have changed. My understanding is that Iranian influence over Hamas has deteriorated because of what's happening in Syria against the Palestinians, and that they're moving. Hamas is now more and more moving into the Egyptian camp.
This is all true, but it's so fragile, and things are very fluid. Things can still change. And again, I must remind you and your listeners that the power of Israel to change the reality in the Middle East is very limited, and one should recognize it, realize it, that Israel cannot, you know, play around as if we are the only power in the region. Whatever will be, will be. We should observe it very carefully, but we can't... Those days are over in which Israel can encourage one regime against the other. No, no, that's not what Israel can do and not what Israel should do.
But Gideon Levy, is that going to translate into Israeli politics? If Israel is increasingly isolated in the region, which seems to be the case, and having lost its relationship with Egypt, relations with Turkey that have now turned sour. How is this translating the general sense of isolation in the region? And is that leading to a more of a kind of right-wing, entrenched, paranoid kind of polity? Or are people being more sober and thinking maybe we're going to have to, you know, reorient our thinking in terms of the region?
Unfortunately, the first option is the right one. Israelis in the last years are becoming more nationalistic, more many times militaristic, more even being arrogant than before, and believing that Israel has to live only on its sword and not on anything else. While the conclusion should have been exactly the opposite. As long as the Israeli occupation goes on, this is a fuel which feeds so many sentiments against Israel in the Arab world. And this should have come to a solution long time ago, and then I think Israel would have been in a much better strategic position.
Well, on that note, if that is your position, and I guess it's not, you're suggesting it's not the majority position, but is there any political movement on the left? Is the left sort of in permanent decline and the right in permanent ascendancy? Is that the reality?
No, unfortunately, there is almost no Israeli left, except of small political groups. But Israel is speaking more or less in one language in the last years, and the differences between these parties are very, very minimal. the difference between Likud and Kadima and even Labor in the political arena are really, really small. And it's not a very healthy sign.
Well, I thank you for joining us. It's an interesting discussion, Gideon Levy.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz and is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres. His books include Twilight Zone, Life and Death Under the Israeli Occupation, and The Punishment of Gaza. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how much the defense budget is going to be cut. Tell you what, and you better think, little more. If you raise up your hand, you better raise up your clan. Fix up, master, and think about it, man. But wait, we really want to fight, yes, we. We really want to fight, what's it crazy? We really want to fight, yes, who? We really want to fight, trust me. We really want to fight, think about it, man. Think before you move. Run, cause you're not get far when you're done. You better call for the law, think you run. You better call for the law, think you run. It's not the end of the world. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Russell Rumbaugh, a co-director for budgeting for foreign affairs and defense programs at the Stimson Center. Previously, he was a defense analyst on the Senate Budget Committee and served as military legislative assistant to Congressman Jim Cooper of Tennessee, and was a lead staffer for Mr. Cooper as chairman of the House Armed Services Committee's panel on roles and missions. He also served as operations research analyst at the Office of Secretary of Defense's Program Analysis and Evaluation, as a military analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, and as an infantry officer in the United States Army, resigning with the rank of captain. Welcome to Background Briefing, Russell Rumbaugh.
Thanks so much for having me.
And the report that you've done for the Stimson Center, What We Bought, Defense Procurement from Fiscal Year 01 to Fiscal Year 2010, indicates that procurement funding grew dramatically from $62.6 billion to $135.8 billion. So does that mean then that this choices that the Secretary Panetta is faced with, having to cut more than $450 billion over the next decade, is there anything to be taken out of procurement then?
Well, unfortunately, the question goes the other way of not is there something to be taken out of procurement, but procurement will be taken out of. The defense budget traditionally cycles. It has fat years and lean years. And every time we turn into a downturn, it's true that procurement pays first. Now, what is often forgotten is although procurement always pays during the down cycles, procurement always also grows faster during the up cycles. And that's one of the things the report does, is go back and look what happened during that up cycle that we've just been through. Did we manage to buy anything while times were good?
Well, wouldn't the real question be, did we buy anything that we really need? Because isn't there a tendency to fight the last war?
Well, actually, I think the more interesting question is the one Secretary Gates posed, of less the tendency to fight the last war as the tendency to fight the next war. As Gates called it, next war-itis. Now, he's not talking about the operations and tactics, but rather about procurement. Our system has a really endemic effort to always look forward. The contractors are always trying to sell the military on the next new thing, the military is always trying to sell Congress on the next new thing, and Congress is trying to prove to its constituents that it's gotten the next new thing, which means we are always looking forward. Sometimes we can get a skewed perspective of where we're at because of that constant look forward.
Well, what we know is that defense spending has doubled to $700 billion a year since 9/11. What have we got for that money? Because obviously a war on terror is a pretty amorphous thing. You know, it's a war against a tactic, not against anything that that we're used to in an historical military context.
And despite that, I'm sure most people won't be surprised that the stuff we got isn't really very amorphous. It looks like the stuff we have often bought: ships, tanks, airplanes. You've already brought it up. The really important question is, have we bought the right stuff? Unfortunately, there's never an easy answer to have we bought the right stuff. What does the future hold? What fight are we going to be doing? You can look back the last 10 years and realize we didn't quite have the right stuff when we started these wars. Now, will we and do we have the right stuff for the future?
Well, we also have to add the fact that that everything's on the chopping block, right? If this, if the super committee can't come to an agreement, there will be across the board cuts, and that, I mean, Panetta is faced with taking out more than $450 billion over the next decade, and that's his mission. But if the super committee can't come to an agreement, then the axe comes down, right? If it deadlocks and fails to reach to find the $1.2 trillion, these automatic cuts, the Pentagon would face a $500 billion in additional reductions over the next decades. So,
of course,
clarify that for us. I mean, in other words, Panetta is supposed to take out $450 billion. What happens if the super committee can't come to an agreement?
So the $450 billion, you've absolutely said it right. And, in fact, we talked about this at the start of the program. $450 billion over 10 years out of something approaching a $6 or $7 trillion defense budget isn't that much, especially compared to past drawdowns. It's only about 80%, whereas the drawdowns in the 90s or in the 70s were more around 30%. Sequester adds a whole other dynamic. To be honest, even at the increased dollar level, that still is not at the drawdown levels we've seen in the past, but it happens in a much different way. It happens in a single year, 10% drop, and as you said, across the board cuts. There's no strategic decision here. There's no choosing what's the best thing we have and what's the worst thing we have. It's every single line item takes a 10% cut, which clearly is not a strategic solution to a defense budget crunch.
Well, but just in terms of drawdowns and the recent ones that you mentioned, mm-hmm. where are we now? Because we're getting out of Iraq for by December the 31st, and we're getting out of Afghanistan starting in 2014. What's the defense budget likely to look like? Say, apparently the Defense Department itself is saying that its spending will drop to $522.5 billion by 2017.
And, of course, it's only talking about the base budget. It's not actually, it's always kept the war budget in a separate conversation. In FY11, we spent $160 billion. Now,
right.
So far, the administration has only asked for, in the recent continuing resolution, has only given $126 billion for FY12. So that's a pretty significant drop already. Nevertheless, I think most people are less concerned about how the war cost drawdown is what is our steady-state defense spending, which, even without the war costs, went up dramatically in the last decade. Is it going to go down now, and how deep is it going to go? Certainly, that's what sequester is pointing out. War costs are exempt from sequester. And it's what the $450 billion you mentioned is coming out of, not war costs, but base costs.
So, if the base cost is about $530 billion, mm-hmm. and defense spending it stands at $700 billion, explain to me what amount above 530 gets us.
Well, there's two parts. 530 is the Department of Defense. There is a broader budget category called National Defense, and that includes the nuclear weapons activities that are in the Department of Energy, and it includes some other monies that go, for instance, to the Coast Guard and the Department of Homeland Security. But that's only about $25 billion. The bulk of the number to get us above $700 billion is those war costs. 530 is FY11 base, and there was $160 billion or $159.3 billion in FY11. That's what takes you above $700 billion.
Again, I'm speaking with Russell Rumbaugh, who is a co-director for budgeting for foreign affairs and defense programs at the Stimson Center. Previously was the defense analyst on the Senate Budget Committee and also serves an operations research analyst at the Office of Secretary of Defense's Program Analysis and Evaluation, as a military analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, and as an infantry officer in the United States Army, resigning with the rank of captain. So I remember years ago, I used to talk with an old friend going back to the Vietnam War days, Colonel David Hackworth, who unfortunately is no longer with us. But he used to, and he was the most highly decorated living soldier, I think, in the U.S. Army. He said that he always referred to the dichotomy within the army and within the military as the choices between the toys and the boys. So where's that stand now? Because the new plans are to cut a lot of cut the army down in number, the Marines down in number. There's even talk of TRICARE, which is the Department of Defense's health program, which has doubled in cost, I think, in the last decade, I believe. Yeah, it's gone up from $50 billion from $19 billion to $50 billion. So give me a sense of how much we're going to be cutting hardware and how much we're going to be cutting from manpower and pay and benefits.
Well, your toys and boys conundrum is absolutely the most interesting question about this build down. In previous build downs, the force had always been at a larger number than before. That was especially true at the end of the Cold War. They dropped the number by 700,000. This time, our force is about the same. And in fact, the Air Force and the Navy are smaller than they were in 2000, despite the increase in the defense budget. In fact, both the Air Force and the Navy tried to go down lower in personnel and found they needed to put their people back to make sure they could maintain their current force structure. The Army always feels like it suffers the most because it is so dependent on people and so is most sensitive to the budget top lines. The next 10 years are going to be really interesting to see, are we going to face a fundamental choice because of those built-in personnel costs? That is exacerbated by the other point you made about health care costs. Health care costs have grown, and of course, although they've grown a great deal for the Department of Defense, that isn't unique to the Department of Defense. Health care costs are growing throughout the country, and that becomes a reality that we have to deal with in the future. Not necessarily something that can just be solved by making a different choice. And that's going to put greater stress on our other choices, the toys versus boys you signed up. Do we keep buying stuff? Do we keep buying the same stuff? Do we keep buying the same force structure, most importantly?
So in terms of the report that you did, Russell Rumbaugh, for the Stimson Center, what we bought defense procurement from fiscal year 01 to fiscal year 2010, just briefly go through, if you will, because we've bought the F-22 fighter. There's been a lot of criticism about whether and that's the most effective platform out there. The C-17, I think didn't we buy more than we needed? I think the Pentagon wanted to close the line, but I think our local senators out here kept it open in Long Beach. So we know about how the system works with going back to Eisenhower's warning. So give us an assessment of what we've bought now to the point where maybe we don't need to buy any more. And because my understanding is that Gates tried to reorient spending towards drones and cyber warfare and things that he felt were 21st century as opposed to big expensive toys.
Well, I think the most important thing my report takes away with is often people assume that the money we've spent in the last 10 years was consumed by the war, that because this money, because these wars are going on, so much of the money we spend is disappearing in daily operations. And certainly there's some of that. But in just terms of procurement, which is buying stuff, only 8% of the $1 trillion we spent on procurement was spent on ammunition. And that 8% number includes things like missiles, not just the rounds being fired by individual soldiers' rifles. So 92% of funding was spent on other stuff. And not surprisingly, when you spend more than $900 million on stuff, you get some pretty good stuff. Unfortunately, to look at what you bought, the only way to do it is go service by service, because each of them control their own acquisition strategy, and each of them are pursuing the priorities they think are most important. You brought up the Air Force, which is one of the most telling examples, because the Air Force clearly made a choice. They chose quality. They had the number one and number two largest procurement programs within the Department of Defense last 2 years, or I'm sorry, 10 years, the F-22 and the C-17, both of which you mentioned. Now, first of all, both of those aircraft are incredible aircraft. They do things nothing else in their class does. There's a reason they are such high-end aircraft. They truly do things nobody else can imagine. But, of course, that has a price. They are also more expensive than other types of planes. What's better, buying a lot of something cheaper or buying a few of something more? Well, that always depends on the situation. But it's the choice the Air Force made was to buy few at a high price. And because of that, we have the best fighter aircraft in the world and we have the best transport aircraft in the world. I'm sorry, I just have to defend Congress a little bit. Yes, Secretary Gates made the C-17 a great example of Congress buying things the Pentagon didn't want. Of course, it's always interesting to figure out whether just because the Pentagon wants it means it's necessary or not. The original plan was to buy more than 200 C-17s, and that was brought down in the 90s when times were tight. Congress forced the Pentagon to buy more than they expected. But, of course, Congress is the one who has the power of the purse, and they're the ones who are going to make that choice in the end.
But this is a zero-sum game. So your question you really have to ask yourself, Russell Rumbaugh, is do we need the extra transportation as opposed to what Gates was wanting, which was more drones? And he apparently was getting resistance from the Air Force because they don't like pilotless aircraft. And now apparently drones are literally pilots actually use the toggle switch, from what my understanding.
The opportunity costs are always the question. Obviously, you would like to have anything and everything, but that's not possible for anybody, including the Department of Defense, despite the sums we spent. There's always more you could have. And the drones are one of the most interesting stories out there. The Air Force, for a number of years, has claimed to be following a high-low strategy. They would buy a few of very high-end aircraft and buy a lot of a lower-end aircraft. That's what they did in the 1980s, buying the F-15 and the F-16. F-15 was very high-end and a little bit expensive. The F-16 was very cheap, but they could buy a lot of it. Because of Secretary Gates' pressure on the drones, the Air Force has sort of backed into a high-end, high-low strategy. They have the F-22 on the high-end, and then they have these pilotless drones, which now there's several hundred of them already in the inventory because of this last decade's spending.
And I take it that there'll be more. I mean, don't they want to go from the one that they have now to the Reaper? Is that the new one?
That's right. And in fact, they've already started buying the Reaper within the last 10 years. Not only they field the first generation drone, the Predator, mm-hmm. bought several hundred of them. They've already developed and fielded the next generation, the Reaper, which they have bought, and they've already bought about 30% of the total they plan on buying for that aircraft as well. So the good times are good times, and the Air Force and everybody else managed to buy a lot of what they wanted, more than they originally expected.
Well, now we get to the crunch, Russell Rumbaugh. When you talk about the good times, the good times are over for a lot of Americans, right? I mean, we've got people camping out in the streets around the country, and we've got a real sense that there is a serious fiscal crisis in this country. You've got Tea Party members and liberals in Congress arguing that the cuts that Panetta is about to make, the $450 billion, are not sufficient. There is this sense out there that there has to be, talk about across-the-board cuts, there has to be across-the-board sacrifices.
Well, and again, I would refer, let's discuss what we've seen in the past. The cuts being talked about right now are really small compared to past drawdowns. Now, some of that will be eaten up by the war funding going down as well. But nevertheless, right now, we're just at the start of it. The FY11 budget basically froze the Defense Department budget at its FY10 levels. That's not quite a drawdown yet. That's more just the inflection point. And we still don't have a final number for FY12 as the appropriators make their final dispositions here in the coming weeks. And we'll see if that starts tipping down a little bit more, and it's in these coming years under the caps of the Budget Control Act that's likely to really start biting.
So I guess the takeaway then from this conversation is that that these dire threats that are coming or these doomsday scenarios from people saying that, you know, that the across the board cuts will be a disaster, that you're suggesting that to head that off in Panetta's task of taking out $450 billion is not going to be that difficult?
It's still going to feel painful, even though we've done it before and we're likely to do it again. It's tough to compare. The U.S. military is so much bigger and better than anything else in the world. The doomsday scenarios don't really have anything to compare to. Nevertheless, the U.S. military also does more than anybody else in the world, and that demand keeps up a large number of requirements even when times are tough. Nevertheless, given our debts and deficits, it seems very clear that the defense budget will be going down in the coming years.
But just an added thought, though. My understanding is that with Petraeus at the CIA, with what happened in Libya, there's a lot of talk now, isn't there, of that lots of boots on the ground are counterproductive. Arguably, they were counterproductive in Iraq, and they played into bin Laden's playbook. And some people argue they're counterproductive in Afghanistan, given how few boots on the ground originally defeated the Taliban in the early part of that war. So aren't we heading into a new strategic landscape where there'll be fewer boots on the ground, more use of local assets, but use of drones and air power and naval power, which is what we're doing in Somalia, right? We're using the Ugandans and the Kenyans to do the fighting. We use the Libyans to liberate themselves. Is that where we're heading?
Well, most interestingly from a defense budget perspective is the defense budget is broken up traditionally in very even amounts. It's roughly a third to the Army, a third to the Navy, and a third to the Air Force. And that has been true ever since the end of the Vietnam War. Now, all those issues you just described, interesting, you can hear the Navy and Air Force talk about that, talk about how our futures in the Pacific were not actually going to be occupying countries. What we haven't yet heard is either the Navy or the Air Force saying, oh, the Army's budget should go down. What we have heard is the other side. The Secretary of the Army has said, I believe even though the defense budget is going down, that one-third, one-third, one-third is going to continue, and the Army will continue to get its share. Obviously, that's a little bit different than your question, which is predicated on strategy. And what I just described, how can, as an old boss used to say, the service shares have remained the same from hot war, cold war, and no war. That is a dynamic we'll wait to see in this next 10 years of whether that becomes disconnected and we actually make a strategic choice about how to spend our defense budget.
Well, I thank you for joining us today, Russell Rumbaugh.
Well, thank you very much for the time, and I hope it was worthwhile.
It definitely was. And again, I've been speaking with Russell Rumbaugh, who's co-director for budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense Program at the Stimson Center. Previously, he was a defense analyst on the Senate Budget Committee, and he also served as an operations research analyst at the in the Office of Secretary of Defense's Program Analysis and Evaluation, and as a military analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, and as an infantry officer in the United States Army, resigning with the rank of captain. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back with another perspective on cutting the defense budget.
At least, it's not the end of the world. No, 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 no. At least, it's not the end.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Hartung, who's Project Director at the Center for International Policy. He was previously a Senior Research Fellow at the New American Foundation's American Strategy Program and Director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy? A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hartung.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And we were just speaking with Russell Rumbaugh, who's had very extensive experience inside the defense and intelligence world in terms of budgeting. He says that since the military budget has doubled since 9/11 for several years now, a decade, that there's been quite a lot of procurement that's going on. It hasn't all been spent on wars. And so what does that mean to your mind then, as Panetta faces this choice of having to take $450 billion out of the defense budget in the next decade? Otherwise, he'll be hit with the blunt instrument that would come out of the super committee if they fail to come to an agreement.
Well, you know, I think Panetta's trying to be, win the turf war, and he's going to keep as much money for his department as possible. But actually, you know, the down payment, the $450 billion, is barely, it's a little less than keeping up with inflation. So it's not a huge cut. And of course, the Pentagon wants to spend over $6 trillion in the next 10 years. So $450 billion sounds like a lot, but when you have that huge, huge set of plans, it's not quite as intimidating. Even the $1 trillion that might hit if the super committee fails and there's automatic triggers that affect the Pentagon would put spending back to about 2007 levels, which by historical standards are quite high. So, you know, I think the real problem is the Pentagon and the contractors are used to having money flow freely. They want to keep it that way. And also, of course, they've mismanaged a lot of the money that they've received. And so in that respect, from their point of view, the more the better.
So we don't know whether the taxpayer is getting value for money with this new contracting raid on the Treasury, if you will. But what I think we do know is that it's permanent, right? That Cheney and company have placed this in the procurement system now, and it's locked in. In other words, the privatization juggernaut has moved on and can't be undone. Is that right?
Well, I think certainly not in its entirety, because they've sort of set things up so they're dependent on, these companies to do the laundry, to help them build bases overseas, to maintain equipment, and do guard duty in various places. So there have been recommendations from different places, including a colleague of mine when I was at the New America Foundation, who did a study on this, who said, "Well, don't let them have positions where they're carrying guns in a war zone." I think that would be a very positive reform, but I think that in itself would be quite difficult as well, because they're hiring former Green Berets, former Navy SEALs. They sort of view it as, they're getting these trained people as opposed to, sort of a new recruit. And, of course, it's at a huge cost. But the military seems, as you said, kind of structured almost, to depend on these contractors to do business.
So, William Hartung, if this super committee deadlocks and fails to find the $1.2 trillion in deficit reductions, then the automatic trigger comes in where the Pentagon would face a $500 billion in additional reductions over the next decade. Now, that may not be really the end of the world, even though there are all these dire predictions out there, given how much more we spend above what we were spending in the last decade. It's doubled, and we're spending more than the rest of the world combined. So you have this interesting alliance now where you've got the kind of Ron Paul people on the Tea Party side and a bunch of liberals on the Democratic side basically saying, that the sky's not falling and these cuts aren't enough. Do you think there's a chance that they could form a winning coalition?
I think there's definitely a chance. There's a lot of the Tea Party types who just, they don't want any kind of spending to happen without some sort of offset, some sort of cut elsewhere.
and also they don't support tax increases. So, you know, there'll come a point where, you know, some of them, you know, they've said, well, if you have to choose between a tax increase and reducing military spending, they said, well, I would reduce military spending. So there is that possibility. And, you know, if anything, I think the liberal side needs to be shored up a bit. I mean, there's people like Barney Frank and people from the Progressive Caucus like Barbara Lee. But there's, you know, in leadership positions in the Democratic Party, there hasn't been a lot of talk about cutting beyond what Obama has suggested. So people like Carl Levin from Michigan and the ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services and the top leadership of the Democratic Party in both houses have been relatively silent about the notion of further reduction. So I think that would be, you know, if some of those people came over onto the side of sort of, you know, sensible reduction, then I think the dynamic would change dramatically.
And William Hartung, again, Project Director of the Center for International Policy and author of most recently of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. There's nothing more, I think, obscene and self-serving than Buck McKeon, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, breaking down in tears when he talks about our young men and women in uniform and the great sacrifices that they go through. Glenn Beck does the same thing on his TV and radio show. He brings him to tears, this patriotic fervor about what great soldiers and we have. But basically, we basically take care of the toys and not the boys, and that's the reality, in spite of all of that patriotic rhetoric. And now you've got McKeon and the rest of the Republicans who are dead against any Keynesianism in terms of stimulating the economy and bringing jobs back. And at the same time, military Keynesianism is okay. So, I mean, Krugman pointed this out recently in a column, what a hypocrite McKeon is, you know, that the Republicans won't do anything to get Americans back to work. But heavens forbid you should cut the defense budget, and then they cry jobs, jobs, jobs.
Well, it's fascinating because, it ends up, in addition to the hypocrisy factor, that military spending's about the worst way to create jobs. It's high salaries. There's not a lot of people doing extra production. It's almost sort of like a boutique operation in many cases. You hire teachers, you do energy efficiency, you work in infrastructure. Any of those would provide, 1.5 or more times as many jobs. Even a tax cut would do better than military spending. So, you know, if they really wanted to fight on that turf, the facts don't really support them. But, you know, in an ideal world, you would figure out what you need to defend the country, and that's what you would spend. You know, you wouldn't make these arguments about jobs. But, of course, that argument has really been kind of drowned out by fear-mongering. You know, so you have Panetta saying, you know, it's a doomsday scenario if the super committee cuts kick in, and you've got the chiefs of the services talking about how, you know, we could barely get across the ocean if, you know, the Navy would be hamstrung if we had these cuts. But they're, you know, far less than during any other build down in the history of the country. You know, much deeper cuts at the end of the Cold War, after Vietnam, after Korea. And I think this is one of those same kind of turning points where there's got to be a decision about what role the U.S. military is supposed to play in the world. And that's been, that debate has been sorely absent in the Congress and in a lot of the press coverage of this.
So what do you think is the who's got the upper hand? I mean, all of these, the sky is falling stuff seems to be capturing the headlines, in the press. I guess in a way, the Tea Party people are pretty good at capturing headlines. So in this battle, we know that the military-industrial complex has the more lobbyists than anybody else, so tell me about whether you think that's going to how that's going to pan out.
Well, I think, you know, if it was just based on traditional measures of political power, number of lobbyists, campaign spending, the fact that they can play the jobs card, you know, you would assume that the military-industrial complex is going to win this battle. But I think because of the nature of the deficit fight the fact that revenues seem to be off the table, the fact that I think there'll be, hopefully there will be some sort of deadlock over cutting entitlements, and there, you know, those won't be shaved back dramatically. So then it comes down to a very small part of the budget. And if the Pentagon doesn't take a cut, then everything else in the budget other than Medicare and Social Security would be so drastically cut that, I think you would see pushback from people all over the country. So I think because of that, you know, unless the only option where I see the pressure being reduced on the arms lobby is if Congress just says we're not going to reduce the deficit at all, and the politics of the moment don't seem to favor that. So I think they're working against some kind of economic and historic trends, which makes it a bigger climb for them to necessarily get what they want this time around. And you know, historically, the arms lobby has had to take its hits. Not, you know, usually it's you know, decades apart, but I think this might be one of those times where they're you know, even all the power that they have is not going to be enough to get them everything that they want.
So if we, just in closing then, if we save a lot of money from getting out of Iraq and pulling out of Afghanistan in 2014, is there going to be any peace dividend? We've had these drawdowns in the past that have been much, much more radical than anything we're talking about now. So it seems like the defense hawks in the military-industrial complex have somehow gotten away with raising the bar and keeping this high, outrageously high $700 billion figure, which, you know, outspends the entire world combined. That's become the new normal.
Well, unfortunately, it has. And, you know, a lot of the screaming about cuts really has to do with, you know, slowing the rate of growth of that, you know, unbelievable figure. And then there's going to be a fight that's already kind of beginning over the reductions in war spending, because the, you know, contrary to people like the Stimson Center, who pointed out that the military has actually modernized itself in the middle of these two wars, the advocates of high spending are saying, oh, we have to take the money that was going to the wars and use it to you know, reset the military and refurbish our equipment and buy new things that we sort of deferred during the wars. So that even the savings on the war spending is going to be subject to, you know, a serious political fight.
Well, I thank you for joining us, William Hartung, here today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with William Hartung, who's project director at the Center for International Policy. Previously, he was a research fellow at the New America Foundation's strategy program and the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy? A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.